ZFM.
ZFM.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM.
This picture, truly one of the most unusual ever filmed, contains scenes which under no circumstances should be viewed by anyone with a heart condition or anyone who is easily upset.
For a fantastic adventure into the future, a monstrous world of terror and chaos. For when this switch is thrown, the universe will face havoc. The Earth will be devastated by the cosmic monsters. But what of the human element? Can man withstand the incredible force of this uncontrollable holocaust from outer space? It was all up to the scientist and his beautiful assistant. Could they stop this terror, or would they too be swept up by these incredible cosmic monsters from the unknown? For king-size thrills and breathtaking suspense, see this charge of dynamite, an explosion of terror you will never forget.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. He led from the front, conducting more raids on the coast of occupied Europe than any other man in World War II. Royal Navy Commander Harold Goulding, DSO, finally gets the recognition he deserves. But why did it take 70 years? Yes, where were we last week enjoying the celebration of the life and World War II exploits of Commander Harold Goulding? But why has it taken those 70 years HMS Northney, which trained the Royal Navy's elite commandos and special forces in Hayling Island. We remembered him last Friday. Also, killing the host. How did we allow a parasitic financial system to grow up around us? Advisor to Greece's Syriza party and author of the book of the same name, Michael Hudson, explains. Also, Kevin Cahill joins us to talk about Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Skype and Yahoo. Are they just the front end of the US National Security Agency that's using all these as shop windows to hoover up everything about us? Also, why is the Goddard inquiry into VI paedophile child sex abuse and murder using staff from the Home Office, which it's supposed to be investigating? And one airliner that was allowed to leave otherwise closed US airspace on the afternoon of the 9/11 attacks. Who was on it? And where was it heading? We hear from the author of Solving 9/11, Chris Bolin. Plus, it's Marty Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first, I'm joined by Kevin Cahill. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, you've come in particularly, I think, today to talk about the NSA. But let's start with some of the revelations that there have been recently about the VI paedophile scandal. And there's a particularly fascinating article by Leah McGrath-Goodman, which is in Newsweek. After years of horrifying revelations, she says, about sexual abuse of children by people of power and influence, Britain has called in a judge from New Zealand in a bid to guarantee the independence of a new inquiry. In an opening statement, she said she will lead a team that will investigate thousands of allegations into abuse perpetrated by people of prominence in public life. But then she goes into question, and she's quoting from many of the survivors, to say, why are staff from the Home Office being used in this inquiry when the Home Office itself is supposed to be under investigation?
I don't even begin to understand why none of our own national newspapers have carried this. 70% of the staff for the Goddard inquiry, it turns out, now come from the Home Office, the government ministry that's most likely to be the target of the inquiry.
So what can be done about that?
It's very hard to know what to do. Leah Goodman has discovered a couple of other things. There are crucial papers from the Permanent Secretary and the Home Secretary's private files that are missing for the beginning of the cover-up. The second thing she discovered is there are files in the National Archives of children's homes going back years in the control of the Home Office. They were Home Office children's homes. And these files were shown to nobody. They weren't shown to the Oneless Inquiry, nothing. So into all this come 70% of the staff from the Home Office to conduct an objective inquiry.
Well, it can't possibly be objective, can it? I'm reminded, Martin, of the Operation Gladio inquiry, where the fascist terrorist in Italy, Vincenzo Vinciguerra, says the state cannot find itself guilty.
Well, yes, and of course these kind of questions are being raised here. As I constantly stress, I think that the real thing that people need to focus on here is the use of paedophilia by the intelligence services as a tool for blackmail, which is why it's become so widespread. We're not just talking about people having bizarre proclivities and then being protected. It's a systematic use of paedophilia as a means of blackmailing various political figures.
Kevin, what do you make of that?
No, this takes you to a central a word that's cropping up everywhere, Kinkora.
Yeah.
The reason Kinkora is cropping up is because it's one of the very few homes about which anything is known. But looking at the closed and secret files, the Home Office Children's Homes files in the National Archives, there's 120 of them that were subject to inspection because things were going wrong. So what Martin says, as far as I can see, using disturbed children from children's homes was a policy of MI5. And what they are scared stiff about is that Kinkora is working loose.
What's been the effect, Kevin, you think, over the years of this, then? If this has, you know, as you both of you are suggesting here, that the VI paedophiles were being used as kind of political puppets, what's been the effect over the years of this?
The whole of our political life has been corrupted. People like these security and intelligence officials have been able to blackmail elected members of parliament, government ministers. And what the picture we get of our politicians is, you know, elected by the people and having a mandate from the people has been completely destroyed.
Another story that's come out recently, this is actually in July, in The Guardian, in various other outlets, is that the BBC has forced out the team which was behind exposing the Savile story. This is Merian Jones in The Guardian. He's saying basically BBC journalists will be afraid of speaking out about the next big BBC scandal after seeing how those who tried to expose Jimmy Savile were forced out, according to the former head of investigations at Newsnight. Marion Jones said the way he and other journalists who complained about the way the BBC had handled the scandal were pressured to leave.
Yeah. I mean, there's a rumour in London that Panorama are underway to undermine the whole paedophile thing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there is a serious problem with both the allegations and the unfortunate people making them. And certainly amongst those who are interviewing people in London, there's a belief that up to 50% of the allegations may be, if not untrue, may not be verifiable. And it's understood that Panorama have launched a programme to try and you know, deflate the whole thing and rubbish it.
Amazing. Among those who Marion Jones says were also targeted by bosses over Savile included his colleague, and my old colleague actually, on the investigation, Liz McKean. She left after 23 years with the corporation in April 2014 and now works on Channel 4's Dispatches, Martin.
Well, if what we suspect is true, that the intelligence services were using children's homes as a means of political blackmail, you can bet your bottom dollar that they're going to be pulling all the stops out to protect themselves. The police this week, when they were investigating Harvey Proctor, he suggested that the person who's accusing Harvey Proctor said that both the head of MI5 and the head of MI6 were involved in abuse of him. Now, that's what the allegations are.
Well, those would be the allegations if you wanted to discredit the whole thing. This is what it's about.
Well, it could be. I mean, one of the ways to try and discredit something like this is to create unbelievable allegations or what have
you. Is this a sort of straw man theory, Kevin?
Yeah. No, the police, the Wiltshire police did a press conference, which is impolitely known in London circles as the Guilty House press conference. But the police implied or suggested that these were the first allegations against Ted Heath. They weren't. The allegations against Ted Heath were made by identified officers in MI5 in 1974 and circulated by Colin Wallace. Tony Wedgwood Benn made a very, very important speech in 1990 in which he actually identified the documents. Now, I mean, is anybody going to investigate this?
Well, I tell you what, the IPCC are actually already investigating Wiltshire Police over their inadequate investigations into child sexual abuse in Wiltshire in the past. And yet, for some unbelievable, unknown reason, Wiltshire Police has been decided that Wiltshire Police will be spearheading the national investigation into Ted Heath.
Yeah, as I say, they appear to have told journalists either on the side of that press conference that these were the first allegations of this kind of thing against Ted Heath. Well, they seem very short on their history, and this may be deliberate to avoid saying the deputy head of MI5 was the one who started it, Peter Wright. That's now fully documented. It's in Hansard. The Speaker of the House of Commons was given the falsified papers. You know, it's crazy.
So, in other words, what you're suggesting, Kevin, is that this was part of Clockwork Orange to try and undermine Heath. Yep. But I think what I take from all of this is the kind of games these people play. And these allegations, whether they're true or false, are part of a game of blackmailing politicians, trying to get results to Heath, if he was involved in sexual activity or whether he wasn't, he's a target for blackmail. And that's what we're talking about here.
But then you've got this guy, Peter Heyman, who was the ambassador to Canada, held...
Well, he's deputy head of MI6 as well, wasn't he?
He had a role in relation to 6. Nobody quite knows what it was, but it was high up. Hmm. Something like a deputy director, but nobody is sure.
Well, tell us about him then. What was his relationship to all this? He was ambassador to Canada as well?
Oh, he was all sorts of things. He was the deputy head of the Foreign Office. He had access to all the British secrets. And nobody nobody discovered he was a raving paedophile with fantasising about murdering children.
So, I mean, can the police be trusted to look into this properly, Kevin? I suppose that's what we're asking here, because you also got the possibility of the police briefing the press wrongly sometimes, in fact also briefing witnesses wrongly about the identity of somebody they're accusing. This can set hairs running and actually really muddy the waters when these investigations actually start to be pursued.
Well, even the Financial Times has rebelled. It had a big article yesterday saying that everybody was getting really disturbed about the way the police are doing the investigation through the media. That's hardly the way you expect a police investigation to be conducted.
Well, what happens is, if someone's been interviewed, then the police won't necessarily do a press release or something, but the media will ask the police, are you interviewing somebody? And then generally they will confirm it or deny it.
Well, Harvey Proctor has thrown a huge spanner in this, because he's effectively said, this is what I was interviewed about. And it's certainly bizarre.
There's also the involvement of Mark Watts and the XRO News website, which I know you're involved in as well, Kevin, in this whole scandal with Harvey Proctor. And when someone comes out and denies all these things, then it's very difficult to know what to think about it, isn't it?
Well, you know, I mean, what can we think? We haven't seen the evidence, so we don't know for sure. But we do know that the people who started this whole thing in 74, the Clockwork Orange project, have never been prosecuted for anything.
This whole business seems to be dragging on and on and on. Isn't that part of the tactics, Martin?
Yes, I mean, the way if you want something just not to happen, you just keep blocking and blocking, don't you? Mm-hmm. Just keep throwing cold water on it and hopes it goes away. I'd like to come back to Kinkora because I think that's a key thing, because I think the evidence there is that MI5 were definitely using it as a place of blackmail, and I think that's accepted across the political spectrum in Northern Ireland, because many of the people blackmailed were loyalist paramilitaries.
And you mentioned Colin Wallace earlier, didn't you? Tell us about him. Who is he?
Well, he was the army press officer in Belfast in 1974 when I was a freelance journalist in Northern Ireland as well as a student. He put out all these smears, particularly about Ted Heath, but about others, Harold Wilson and so on, and he was trying to undermine the elected government of the time. And he was thrown out of the army, although it looks to be on spurious grounds. And then he was convicted of manslaughter with extremely dodgy evidence.
A lot of this was covered by Paul Foote, wasn't it? He covered a lot of this. But I mean, I think what people need to take home from this is that in actual fact, these organisations, intelligence services and the police to some extent, are not to be trusted. They're not to be taken at face value. They do engage in blackmail and they do engage in terrorism.
Do you take a look at Hillsborough? That inquiry, the final one, was conducted by relatively ordinary people. It was not in the hands of the police or lawyers, and look the result we got, the truth. I think the whole situation in Northern Ireland from, say, 72 onwards needs to be gone over again.
But who by? Because, I mean, there were people who were raising questions. Are the police actually up to the job, especially when MI5 are a sort of higher tier and they're sort of almost floating above all this, aren't they, the intelligence services? And when something starts going the way they don't like it, then they'll intervene to pervert the course of justice?
Well, I mean, the original Clockwork Orange stuff looked like treason. It was much worse. It was paid servants of the state trying to bring down the government we, the people, had elected.
So tell us a bit more about that. What's the timescale and who was involved?
Okay, in the early 70s, things went badly wrong in Northern Ireland, far wronger than we, the public, ever understood, because the reporting was corrupted by people like Colin Wallace, who engaged in a campaign against the elected government instead of, focusing his attention on the terrorists.
Well, this is around about the time of Bloody Sunday too, wasn't it?
Bloody Sunday was a total catastrophe, but we now know that the gunfire and everything was never ordered. In other words, the Paris went in and just shot without orders, and it was all, it was murder.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're still going over all of this. I think more importantly, to my mind, is the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which killed the largest number of civilians and the largest number of people on any day of the Troubles. And investigations by the Garda in the Republic have definitely pointed the finger at the Glenane gang in County Antrim as working with MI5. And, of course, that was covered by Panorama not long ago. They did one of the best things they've done in ages about all of this.
Yeah. Panorama are getting closer, but they're not there yet, because we're talking about misinformation, and we're talking about you've got to the serious stuff now, the bombing of Dublin. Nobody has ever been prosecuted for that, and the names of the suspects are widely known in Northern Ireland, in the Irish Republic, and here.
But, I mean, with this current VI paedophile scandal, Kevin, it's going to take more than a panorama to do something. We've seen a lot of accusations and actually very strong evidence about people who are high up in British society, the Whitehall, Westminster types of paedophilia and murder, but we haven't seen any prosecutions of living people. People like Leon Britton, it seems, you know, we wait until someone dies and then it's revealed that the guy is a paedophile.
This is... Yeah.
So what can we do about this? I mean, this is a difficult one, but I'm asking you, how do we get over that to actually start to arrest living, powerful paedophiles?
It may sound slightly to one side, but let me, that we could start where Leah Goodman started, get all the files and publish them. No more secret files, no more lost files, no more hidden files. Let me raise another tiny offside point. Parliament was re-elected in May. All the committees are sitting now and running, except one. The Intelligence and Security Commission committee hasn't been formed and hasn't appeared. So, you know, and none of the media have mentioned it.
Sounds like a banana republic. You know, they've decided they can't actually get agreement between the security services, Conservative Party and Labour as to who's going to be on that committee. Also, maybe they're waiting for the new Labour Party. But anyway, they should have an interim committee, Martin. Anyway, what's your thoughts about how we actually start getting arrests and trials of living VIP paedophiles?
Well, we've got to rely upon the idea of police independence. Now, the police may, in fact, not be doing their job properly or may be implicated, but that doesn't mean that the police are not the first port of call. I mean, in Northern Ireland, for example, all sides of the community have decided to support the police service of Northern Ireland despite their unhappiness with the previous incarnation as the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And that's the only way forward. If the police aren't doing their job properly, kick them out and put some policemen in there and women in there who do know how to do their job properly.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now we're going to have a look at, again with Kevin, at the National Security Agency. National Security Agency. Martin, if you can just give us that, please. We'll start like this. Let me introduce our reporter, Kevin Carhill from Exeter, and Vanny Vines, Kevin's personal press officer at the National Security Agency at Fort Meade in Maryland, USA, home of the largest spook agency in the world.
Hi, Vanny. It's me, Kevin, from England. How's the good old National Security Agency of the USA on this fine fall day?
Dandy, Kevin, just dandy. Now, what can I do for you?
Ah, Vanny, it's PRISM, you see. That email interception and data theft program you run over here. In the words of the song from Annie Get Your Gun, anything you can do, we can do too. So we're asking the government to enact a Rob American Banks Act, RABA for short.
A what, Kevin?
A special act of Parliament to legalise the robbing of American banks.
Hey man, that's crazy, you can't do that.
Oh yes, we can. By a majority of one, our Parliament can vote to dethrone our Queen. Getting an act through to rob your banks would be a lot easier.
You'd not get past the doors of a US bank before the cops were there.
Now, Vanny, we're imitating you. We're going to take the money from the 200 American banks over here.
But what we're doing is different. It's legal. We have a law here.
Legal on your side of the pond, Vanny, but not on ours. I know it will shock you to the core, but your laws don't run over here. That's why we'll take the money from your banks over here. That will be quite legal for us. We'll not call it robbing banks, just taking compo.
Our government will stop you.
Good point, Vanny. So far, our government, a crowd of cowardly cretins in Downing Street, have let your government break the law over here, steal children's data and intercept emails. Not nice, Vanny. So we expect a lot of support for RABA. We will suggest giving everyone who had data stolen by you £1,000. That will be about 80% of the population.
We'll send in the Marines.
I thought you might think of that, Vanny, but we have our own Marines. We think they'll obey our laws, not yours. See you in the city, Vanny, with our Marines.
Okay, thank you, guys. But there's a serious point in the middle of all that, Kevin, isn't there? And that is that effectively what's going on at the moment is the surveillance program PRISM is actually invading all of our homes here in Britain, including gathering information that our children are doing on the internet. So you may have some kind of idea of, well, protecting kids from seeing content that you don't want them to on the internet, but actually still the NSA, through these effectively kind of front operations, it is collecting vast amounts of data on all of us, including kids.
Yep. No, this is completely proven. One of the peers back in June described PRISM as criminal. And I have contacted the Home Office and the Cabinet Office on a number of occasions and asked them to, you know, is this man right or wrong? And they have refused to comment.
Okay, so why is it criminal?
Sorry?
Why is it criminal?
Well, I can't answer that at the moment, but they seem to be afraid of the American government or the American spooks.
Well, haven't we been afraid of the American government ever since the end of the Second World War? I can remember Duncan Campbell writing a couple of very good books back in the 1980s. One was The Unsinkable Aircraft Carrier, describing Britain as America's aircraft carrier. We also talk about Britain as the 51st state. And then he also wrote a book called War Plan UK, which was the first time it had been revealed that effectively, if there was any kind of war situation around the world which Britain was involved in, effectively, we'd have Americans here telling us what to do. We would be just simply part of a US chain of command.
Yeah, I think the issue of whether we have any independence over the Polaris missile should be raised again, over Trident. But this is the first time the United States has ever intruded right into the domestic life of the United Kingdom and stolen, you know, private data from everybody. And that includes Parliament.
Well, one of the things that Duncan Campbell said in his recent article on The Intercept was the reason that motivated him to look into it. And, of course, this was a part of a secret society series. There was quite a lot in the 1980s when the BBC made programmes like that back in the 80s, which was he was saying effectively that the National Security Agency, Menwith Hill, the surveillance of phone lines, which was, of course, it was before the days of the internet, but that sort of thing could enable the imposition of a police state in Britain overnight.
Easily, because the front, what you call the front operation, the method they're using to steal the data and intercept the emails, affects about 80% of the users of the web in Britain.
How have you got evidence then that these internet companies are doing deals with the National Security Agency? You've obviously seen some of the Edward Snowden revelations about PRISM, because I wonder sometimes how companies like Twitter actually manage to be valued so much. Are some of these internet companies, people like Google, for example, actually taking money from the NSA?
They are indeed. This probably the company taking the biggest amount of money is Microsoft. But you ask, how did I prove it? The PRISM contracts are on the web. It's probably, you know, millions of people have seen them. Just look it up, PRISM, and it comes up. I have actually contacted all the companies, and I've sued three of them. And I'll be back. The first time, I lost because the law in Britain wasn't clear that you could sue American companies here. And last March, the appeal court fixed that. They have reminded people that if you do things in this country, you are liable under our laws.
Martin, what do you make of all this? Because effectively what it's doing is it's opening up Britain's privacy to the US National Security Agency.
Well, traditionally, before the modern internet and so on, the echelon, the Five Eyes, the deal was that you couldn't. The British.
Can I just stop you there? Because Five Eyes is a weird one, isn't it? It's five countries with five eyes. But no, hang on. Five countries should be 10 eyes. It's almost like each of these countries is just one eye.
Yes. Okay. Fair, interesting aside. But the point is, the way they used to finesse it back in the 80s was that the British spies would spy on the American population and then tell the Americans what GCHQ, because of course GCHQ can spy on foreigners perfectly legitimately, and the US would do the same for the British and then give them the information. And of course the British and US intelligence services are part of the same game. They're pretty much the same outfit.
Well, there is this one great curiosity that GCHQ have issued a statement saying that they expect American companies in the United Kingdom to obey our laws. This is a bit of a novelty.
Yes, but it's. I mean, I hate to be so cynical, but actually, nobody is going to go into these companies and take evidence that will be able to be used in a court of law, because they're all very, very hot on security. I mean, particularly people like the NSA and GCHQ are not going to let you or I, as journalists, wander in there and grab information, evidence, which then could be used against them to prove their criminal intent in a court.
No, the evidence is what you might call formal and forensic, and it's on the web, and it's in statements like those made by that peer in June, by Lord Laird. But here's an interesting point, and it's about the police. The police are aware of this, and the police in Devon and Cornwall are looking at it. What they're doing, I don't know. But the Home Office has tried to stop them. So you go back and say, well, who's stopping the police? Intercepting emails is a criminal offence under RIPA 1. So if the police are doing nothing, why not? And the answer is, knock on the door of Downing Street. Downing Street has stopped every attempt to bring the American companies to justice in English courts.
What about the news today about people not getting their money through electronic bank accounts? Because this is a whole new world we're living in now, where everything seems to be digital money. We're moving away from cash. More and more of the money we spend is used on our little chips. I was noticing it's an RFID chip, isn't it, that's in your credit card nowadays and your debit card, which can be used for contactless payments. And you can't even get on a London bus now with cash.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to bring the country to a complete halt, it's not very difficult. You just put really nasty bugs into the banking system, and that would probably be the most disastrous.
I mean, Martin, do you think that the banks are really motivated to stop that? Because at the end of the day, they can always just hold their hands up and say, sorry, Gov, we were hacked.
Well, I think that what it shows is the vulnerability of all of these systems. I understand. I mean, look at Snowden. He basically was able to get an MP3 with virtually everything they knew on it just by sitting as a low-level subcontractor in the setup. And, of course, what's actually happening in Russia and so on is they've gone back to using typewriters and not using telephones and so on. And if you're serious about security, that's what you got to do.
But here's one of the problems. Take that really simple one. I know that my emails are being intercepted. The evidence is compelling. And the Investigatory Powers Tribunal has acknowledged that PRISM is running and has deemed it unlawful. Now, I want to do something about that, and I discover I can't do anything. You've got to go to the police. I went to the police 18 months ago, and they've done nothing. And as far as I know, this is because of pressure from Downing Street in the Home Office.
Another angle on all this, I suppose, is the increasing power of the... I mean, we're talking about the NSA. The NSA budget's being used effectively to pay these internet companies. Quite what they're doing in exchange for it, is it the PRISM program that they're paying them for?
Yep.
For cooperation with the PRISM program?
Actually, it's surprising that some of the American media haven't actually looked at the accounts of the NSA and discovered how much money they are paying Microsoft, Apple. One of the curiosities, I asked Apple a month ago under the Safe Harbor Agreement to give me the National Security Agency's data protection principles, because the PRISM documents say that Apple is collecting information and being paid by the NSA. So Apple's answer is, never heard of PRISM.
No, come on. Yeah. Come on, Apple.
I have it in writing.
You see, obviously, they're very, very sensitive about this. I mean, we like to think that your Mac is something, it's a sort of cut above Microsoft and whatever, but of course, it clearly isn't. They're just two sides of the same coin. Martin, on a slightly different tack, great bit of investigation here by Press TV. Private US military contractors are indebted to shareholders, they say. The US government has over 200,000 soldiers in over 120 countries around the world, yet it's got an insatiable political appetite to use private military contractors. The total amount that the US spends on defence is $771 billion. Estimates vary, but up to a quarter of all defence spending goes on these private contractors. So we're talking about something like $200 billion on these private defence contractors. One example which goes beyond this amount is a spy agency dubbed Booz Allen, which has been revealed that 70% of the US intelligence budget goes to private contractors. That's what they say, especially on drone surveillance. So we've got this kind of massive industry growing up. Have you seen any documentaries about private defence contractors? I see nothing about this. Their role in destroying countries and then also their role in supposedly rebuilding them.
Well, it's clearly a great big, on one level, it's a great big boondoggle, isn't it? There's loads of money being made out of the war on terror. But the other thing is, just from a security point of view, how can you privatise security of a state? Because it's basically not secure. You've not got a real military line of command.
Well, the problem is there that the company may be outbid by somebody else secretly behind the scenes.
Yes, well, we might as well. Why don't we get the Chinese security agency in to run it all? They'd do it at half the price, eh? But of course, you can't.
Yeah, no. It was Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, and this is just its new form. A lot of the war in Iraq was fought by private contractors, not by the American military.
I suppose they are lobbying themselves, so they're lobbying for war. Martin, where are we at the moment in, for example, places like Ukraine and the Middle East?
Well, they're not just lobbying for war. What we suspect is that they're actually engaged in the commission of terrorism and then saying, oh, we need some more resources to deal with the terrorism that we've created.
Well, have you got evidence for that?
Yes, there's lots of evidence for that. I mean, we mentioned Gladio earlier on. Going back to the 60s and 70s and 1980s.
Well, hang on. What about now?
Well, what about now? The terrorism. Look at what's happening
ISIS,
in Syria.
ISIS.
Look at ISIS in Syria. The Turkish police have actually demonstrated some independence. So they've done a couple of things. One of the things they did is they stopped a convoy of trucks going into Syria, taking arms to ISIS. And the people driving those trucks turned out to be MIT officers. That is to say, Turkish intelligence officers. You know what's happened to those Turkish police officers? They're now on trial for treason in Turkey. But the MIT is part of NATO, so we've got absolutely solid evidence there of a recent ilk that NATO is involved in supplying weaponry to ISIS.
And we've also got a lot of banksters around, and one of the people that I've heard recently, a really fascinating analysis of what's going on with the economic system, is a chap called Michael Hudson. He's written a book called Killing the Host. I know you've talked about this before, Martin, haven't you? The idea that the financial system is like a parasite.
Indeed, and Michael Hudson is one of the top people who's able to take it apart, a bit like Steve Keen, who we had a clip of earlier in the programme.
And here he is on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, talking about, first of all, the banksters, I suppose, the criminality that's now in the financial system here in the West, particularly, and then also talking about Greece, because he's an advisor to the Syriza party.
Michael Hudson, your book is titled Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy. Explain what you mean.
Well, most people think of parasites as sort of just taking money from the economy, and the 1% is sort of sucking up all the income from the 99%. But in nature, what parasites do, they don't simply take. In order to take, they have to take over the brain of the host. And economists have a word, host economy. It's for a foreign country that lets American investors in. Smart parasites help the host grow, but the parasite, first of all, has to make the host believe that the intruder is actually part of the body, to be nurtured and taken care of. And that's what's happened in national income accounting in America and in other countries. The newspapers and the media, not your show, but most of the media, treat the financial sector as if that's really the economy. And when the stock market goes up, the economy is going up, but the economy isn't going up at all. And the financial sector somehow depicts itself as the brains of the economy, and it would like to replace government. Larry Summers said is what governments have to pay their debts by privatizing more, essentially by doing what Margaret Thatcher did in England. That's his solution to the crisis. All the governments have to do is balance the budget, sell everything to Wall Street on credit, and we won't have any more problem. And the financial sector is almost whilst at war, not only against labor, as most of the socialists talk about, but against governments and against industry. It's a cannibalizing industry. So now most of the corporations in America are using their income not to do what industrial capitalism did a century ago, not to build more factories and employ more people and make more profits. They're just using it, as I said, to push it to pay dividends and to buy back their shares and to somehow manipulate the financial sector and the stock prices, not the economy as a whole. So there's been a divergence between the real economy and what economists call the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. And they're going in separate directions.
You have been an advisor to the Syriza party in Greece. You're a friend of the former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. Can you talk about what's happening there now and what that bodes for the economy, not only in Greece, but in Europe, maybe even here?
Well, the story begins actually about 4 years ago when Greece had a very large foreign debt taken on basically by the military government and what followed. And it was obvious that as soon as the PASOK, the Socialist Party, came in, they said, look, the debt's much larger than we thought. We can't pay it. And they were going to write it down. The IMF looked in and said, Greece can't pay the debts. We've got to write them down. The board looked in, said they can't pay the debts. But then the European Central Banks came in and said, look, our job as central bankers is to support the banks. Greece owes the debt to essentially French banks and German banks, and we've got to support them. So despite the fact that the IMF was pushing for a debt write-down 4 years ago, the head of the IMF at that time, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, wanted to run for president of France. And he was told by French President Sarkozy, well, wait a minute, if French banks hold most of Greek debts, you can't at the IMF say that we're going to write down the debt. So they didn't. And meanwhile, the Eurozone said, we won't let you, the IMF, be part of our program, the Troika, if you don't pretend that the that Greece can pay the debt. So Greece was left with a huge debt. It was pushed into depression. The GDP fell worse than it did in the 1930s. Finally, the Syriza party came in January. And Varoufakis and Tsipras thought that, okay, we can explain to the finance ministers of Europe that you can't expect to push Greece into a depression, push more austerity, and somehow austerity will enable us to repay the debt. That's crazy. And he thought that he could reason with them. And the Europeans who he was reasoning with, the central bankers, said, we're not here to talk about economics. We're lawyers. We're here to collect money. It doesn't matter that you're going to go into a depression. It doesn't matter that you're going to have another 20% of your population emigrate. We're only here to collect the payments. And if you don't pay, then we're going to pull the plug. And they pulled the plug on the Greek banks a few months ago and said, we're not going to accept any of the bank transfers payments with Greek banks here. So if you're exporting and you want credit for export, you're not going to give it to you. We're going to treat Greece like America treated Cuba and America treated North Korea. You're going to be the North Korea of Europe if you don't succumb, surrender, and pay. And that's why Tsipras said, we don't want to bring an absolute total crisis breakdown because that would bring the right wing to power. Varoufakis said, well, he agrees that there's no alternative but to surrender for the present and try to join hands with Italy, Spain, and Portugal. But he wasn't going to be the administrator of the depression. So you had the referendum, and the Greeks now say, well, no matter what, we're not going to pay. And the Eurozone says, then we're going to just wreck you or smash and grab.
Smash and grab. So, Martin, things have moved on since that interview just last week, which is now the Greeks have announced another general election.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think it's rather... I think they weren't prepared. The Greek population wanted to stay inside the Eurozone and stay inside the Euro club. And that meant that their bargaining position was weakened, because if they should have said we are prepared to pull the house down, but of course you can't force people.
Well,
to
that
say
was
that.
What Michael was saying there is that would possibly have brought in a right far right government.
Well,
Greece.
If you bring the house down, you're bringing the house down, and the consequences are unpredictable. But ultimately, you can't really bargain with these people, as Michael Hudson was pointing out, and it'll take a while until people wake up and we have sufficiently robust social movements led by sufficiently clear-sighted leadership,
look,
which are prepared to take on
the banks. The people in Greece have woken up. They are realising that whatever way they vote, they're still going to get hammered.
Well, the people in Greece haven't woken up because one of the problems was for the Syriza party was that the Greeks wanted not to pay the debt, and they had all the arguments why they shouldn't pay it and why it should be cancelled and so forth. And incidentally, of course, Ukraine's just had 20% of its debt wiped out because they're good guys and they're not problematic, and we need their help to fight the Russians and so on. So it's all political. But the majority, the centre of Greek politics, still wants to stay in the euro and doesn't want to leave
so
the euro.
What's your prediction for this Greek election then? Do you think it's going to be
a coalition.
It seems like Syriza have failed.
There'll be a coalition between the right wing of Syriza and the New Democrats, i.e. the Conservatives, and the left wing of Syriza will have to split. Varoufakis and others are forming a left wing of Syriza. But I think the real problem is in the psyche of the Greek electorate. They've had enough, they're sick of it all, they're fed up, but they're not sick and fed up enough to pull the whole house down and live with the consequences.
Well, what do you make of all this talk there of economic warfare, effectively by central banks, the Germans and the Swiss, as Michael was describing there, against the Greek people?
Well, this is exactly what's going on. It is economic warfare, it's all political. The debts of Greece were owed to private sector banks in France and Germany, and the logical free market solution is to let those banks collapse if that happened, Germany would then be in the economic crisis which it's imposing on everybody else. But those debts were transferred to the public sector, and now the European Central Bank, the public sector, is demanding repayment of debts which were contracted by private parties. And that's what happens all the time. The private sector screws up, it hands the debt, the unpayable part of it, to the public sector, and then it becomes a political decision who's going to pay and on what basis. And don't forget that Greece is actually now thinking in terms of suing the German government for reparations for World War II. And in fact, the German government at the time took a hold of Greece's currency reserves. And of course, at the same time, also Germany itself was let off most of its debts by its international creditors in 1953, something which they failed to remember.
Kevin, what do you make of all of this?
Two tiny things. One is Ireland, where there is a very sharp recovery underway. It's kind of confined to Dublin, but there is. And they're starting to put the bankers on trial.
But, I mean, surely Ireland is having to do the same sort of thing as Greece is. They're privatising their water industry, for example, in Ireland. How's that all going?
There's at least 100,000 people have refused to pay. So there's social unrest.
I wonder how Bristol Water would get on, the worst water company in the country, by the way, according to Ofwat, the regulators, if nobody paid for their water in Bristol.
Well, this is one of the... But civil resistance, it goes back to what Martin was saying. The Greeks don't want to bring the house down because chaos will follow. It's the same in Ireland. But I was going to make... In Ireland, it was far simpler and clearer. Three private banks destroyed the country, but they were able to destroy the country because the government guaranteed them. But look at Iceland, where the recovery is complete, the bankers are in jail, and they let the banks go bust. BCFM.
And now on to another story, and that is our trip down to Hayling Island last weekend. He led from the front, conducting more raids on the coast of occupied Europe than any other man in World War II. Royal Navy Commander Harold Goulding, DSO, finally got the recognition he deserved last Friday. But why did it take 70 years? So we go now to the captain of the Medusa. This was a boat which was taking part, a ship really, I suppose I should say, in the flotilla, which was part of the celebrations to unveil these two blue plaques down in Hayling Island. It was called, I keep saying Operation for some reason, but no, it's HMS Northney, even though it was on the shore, it was where all the commandos were being trained in the Second World War. So let's have a listen now to the Medusa's captain, Alan Watson. I spoke to him last Friday.
I'm Alan Watson. I'm Medusa's skipper and one of her trustees. And today is all about commemorating Commander Goulding, who his granddaughter's here. He was quite a remarkable man, and he was commanding officer of HMS Northney on Hayling Island. A lot of important things happened here. It was the birth of the SBS, amongst other things. there was the parties here that went across and surveyed the D-Day beaches and all sorts of other things. And his life's been largely unrecorded, and this is an opportunity to put that right.
It's strange, isn't it, that someone who'd be so decorated in the war, was in a very important position in the Royal Navy, should take such a long time for him to get proper recognition.
I think it was a combination of everything being wound up and shut down at the end of the war and the secrecy that prevailed. The sort of things that he was involved in just were not spoken about. So the documents would have remained secret, and it was really quite by chance that this all came to light.
Tell us about some of the other units that were under the special boat unit that he was commanding down here.
One of them was called COPP, the Combined Pilotage Party, and one of their tasks was to go across to the other side and survey the D-Day beaches before any landings took place, because it was important to know what the sand composition was, whether the beach was strong enough to drive a tank up it, all that sort of thing.
Well, how do you do that under the noses of the Nazis?
Quite simply, they paddled ashore in little boats, crept up the beach, took sand samples, and paddled away again. And there's one story of one where they're laying on the beach and the sentry walked straight past them. So quite remarkable people, really.
What about other groups that were part of SBU?
They were small-scale raiding parties, and it was a thing that really came out of World War II, was the sort of start of what you might call unconventional warfare, the idea of very small parties that could cause a lot of grief beyond their size. And they formed and trained here, and went off and did raids on all sorts of places.
What about this particular vessel?
Medusa is what's called a harbour defence motor launch, HDML, and she's 72 feet long, weighs 50 tonnes, and the original design concept of these was there was a worry about submarines penetrating UK harbours and causing grief, and so these were designed to patrol offshore of harbours, detect submarines, depth charge them, and then she's heavily armed to sort them out when they came to the surface. As it happens, the threat didn't really materialise, and so this class of vessel, there were some 480 of them, they were used for all sorts of purposes, from convoy patrol to offensive operations, very popular for agent landing, which is primarily why we're here today, because they're a very, very quiet vessel with a tiny radar signature, so they're almost undetectable, sort of the original stealth craft, if you like.
And that was Alan Watson, captain of the Medusa. So he brought us in to the Langstone, which was where the base of HMS Northney was, where we had a ceremony to unveil the blue plaques. And Harold Goulding's grandson, Charlie Goulding, was there.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I know I speak for the Goulding family that are here today about how proud we are and how humbled by today's event. My father would have been emotionally moved to see today unfold. He tried in the 50s to find out what my granddad had been involved in during the war, but due to his clandestine activities and the Top Secrets Act, was unable to gain much information. What my father did already know, my grandmother had some possessions of my grandfather. These being a tunic that had a silk lining of the French coast. It also had buttons that had compasses and various things on them. She also had a machine gun, or his machine gun. We're very good when we used to go around there. She had a machine gun that was my grandfather's that had interchangeable barrels that would fire ally and enemy ammunition. This effort has accumulated in today's flotilla and the plaque unveilings in memory of my granddad. I'm sure she has a lot more to do, and I look forward to more information about granddad into the future. If we could all put our hands together to thank Jill for her efforts, that would be great.
Yes, and if you go into the archives of this show, you'll hear my interview with Jill Goulding I conducted back in January this year. Now, probably the one of the most interesting people there was Ram Seeger from the SBS Society, and I spoke to him too.
My name's Ram Seeger, Ram because my initials are A.M., I was a former Royal Marine and member of the Special Boat Squadron in those days, but now Special Boat Service. My connection is the obvious one, that Harold Goulding was commander of the Special Boat Unit, which was an attempt by Mountbatten to coordinate all the different seaborne special forces, which included the Royal Marine Boom Detachment, who we are probably descended from. But I think we could probably claim descendants from the Special Boat Unit.
Special Boat Squadron, what was that originally designed to do?
Well, they were a special force, so that means moving in small groups in isolated circumstances behind the enemy lines or whatever to carry out reconnaissance tasks or offensive tasks, blowing things up, that kind of thing.
So give us an idea of the sort of operation that might have been conducted out of Hayling Island.
Well, the classic SBS operation probably is Blondie Hester's attack on the shipping in Durand River, Bordeaux. That was a long time ago, but that's still the sort of thing we train for. But
that's Ram Seeger there from the SBS Society. Now, Martin, the real mystery here is why it's taken 70 years, but as you and I have talked about on this show, there was an operation conducted using the COP commandos that were mentioned there to grab Martin Bormann. At least that's the allegation by John Ainsworth Davis under the pen name Christopher Crichton.
Yes, and of course there was a suggestion that the Dieppe, just as we've was possibly a fix by to put John Ainsworth Davis into the German structure so that they would trust him, and in other words that the Dieppe was deliberately failed.
The other thing about the book Op JB, it is that Christopher Crichton, John Ainsworth Davis talks about there, is he said that there was a cover story for the Bormann raid, and that was that the money that they were going to bring out from Nazi Germany at the end of the Second World War was going to be shared out, and then people like Goulding might have been rather annoyed if their men were used for an operation which was effectively where the money was then taken over to South America.
Well, the main allegation in Op JB is that Martin Bormann was rescued by the SBS from Berlin at the end of the war, taken back to Britain and then taken off to Argentina because he knew where all the money was.
Anyway, so if you want to find out more about this, there's two books, Op JB by Christopher Crichton, and the other one is Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. I'm off to Tehran this weekend, so the nuclear deal's been signed and we have a British embassy back again. We'll be taking a look at Iran next week. Sister Show Dialect on BCFM, Tuesdays at noon, more with Steve Keane. So, have a good bank holiday weekend.